Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, views, history, and information. This week, all reading selections are about education. I have an article about HBCU demographics from the New York Times newspaper, followed by interviews with recent Howard University graduates from that school's newspaper, The Hilltop. I'm going to wrap up the program with an interview about black teachers from the University of California at Berkeley News Service. And I'm starting with an article from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper titled, How Atlanta Remains a Higher Education Mecca for Black Students. This was published August 24, 2025, and written by Ernie Suggs. In 1989, following graduation from Atlanta's Frederick Douglass High School, Stacy Renee Robinson Collier dreamed of becoming a student at Clark Atlanta University. Her older sister attended Spelman College, and she wanted that black college experience. However, her father forbade it, fearing the idea of his daughter taking the train to class. She enrolled at Oxford College of Emory University. In many ways, it was a world away from Clark Atlanta. It was 38 miles east of Atlanta and had about 35 black students. I felt like a fish out of water, Robinson Collier said. I needed that black experience. She dropped out after a year, starting a family and built a career in media. In 2020, 31 years after graduating high school, she earned a degree in broadcast journalism. And she says, enjoyed the full black experience from Georgia State University. Several members of the Robinson Collier's family and most of her close friends had attended GSU, where they studied, played sports, socialized, joined Greek organizations, and most importantly, graduated. I know it's not an HBCU, but to us it is, said Robinson Collier, a special education coordinator in Atlanta Public Schools. We're in there. Robinson Collier continued her new family legacy this month by helping to move her son, Richard Collier III, into his GSU campus apartment. Georgia State was his first and only choice, she said. Atlanta's claim as a black mecca for higher education is not just historical. It is active and growing. For more than a century, the city's HBCUs have cultivated black intellectual, cultural, and civic leadership. Now, institutions like Georgia State, with nearly half of its 50,000 students identifying as African American, demonstrate that large-scale equity and opportunity in higher education are possible. Kennesaw State University, about a half-hour drive from Atlanta's city limits, had close to 15,000 black students last year. Several of Atlanta's HBCUs reported receiving a record number of applications for this school year. Together, these schools make Atlanta a place where black futures are not only imagined, but actively built. Atlanta continues to provide a rich ecosystem of culture, business, and politics that complements the academic mission, said Clarissa Merrick Harris-White, senior professor of Africana Studies at Morehouse College. Students don't just earn degrees. They become part of a broader movement, socially, politically, and economically. That reinforces Atlanta's status as a black mecca for higher education. The next section of the article is titled, A Legacy with Numbers Behind It. The phrase black mecca has clung to Atlanta since the 1970s, describing its rare mix of black political power, cultural influence, and economic strength. But the city's higher education record shows that the title isn't just symbolic, it's measurable. A 2013 Metro Atlanta Chamber report showed Atlanta ranked first among the 100 largest U.S. metro areas for growth in African-American full-time college enrollment, number one for the increase in African-American college graduates, and second in total number of African-Americans in college. And the growth hasn't stopped. Census-based estimates from City Data Forum show that in 2020, Southwest Atlanta had close to 20,000 black residents with bachelor's degrees, second only to Uptown D.C. among major black communities. In 2023, Atlantis Universities awarded 34,535 degrees, according to Data USA. More than one-third of these degrees, 10,596, went to black students, making them the largest racial cohort of degree recipients. From Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens, a Georgia Tech alum, to entrepreneur Pinky Cole, a Clark Atlanta grad, to DeKalb County Sheriff Melody Maddox, who was a member of Morris Brown College's famed Bubbling Brown Sugar dance team, Atlanta's colleges and universities have shaped the careers of many black people who lead organizations and businesses that keep the city going and help make its case for the black Mecca. At one time, that title may have belonged to Washington, D.C., with Howard University. Clark Atlanta University President George T. French Jr. said, "But this is the black Mecca for higher education, full stop." The next part of the article is titled, "The Historic Heart, the Atlanta University Center." If Atlanta is the black Mecca for higher education, the Atlanta University Center Consortium is its temple. The AUC, composed of Morehouse College, Spelman College, Clark Atlanta University, Morehouse School of Medicine, and the resurgent Morris Brown College, is the oldest and largest cluster of historically black colleges and universities in the world. Founded between 1865 and 1881, Atlanta University in 1865, Morehouse in 1867, Clark College in 1869, and Morris Brown and Spelman in 1881, the AUC schools formed a network dedicated to teaching fundamentals, training leaders, and preparing African Americans to navigate political and economic power. Morehouse's Merrick Harris White said the legacy is rooted in Reconstruction, when the city became a destination for African Americans from rural Georgia seeking to rebuild their lives, reunite families, and build community. After the Civil War, the city attracted a critical mass of African Americans seeking education, community, and economic opportunity, Merrick Harris White said. The combination of intentional community building, churches, and educational institutions created a concentration of educated African Americans that was rare. Today, the AUC enrolls more than 9,000 mostly black students, a living legacy that stretches from Reconstruction-era classrooms to 21st-century boardrooms, laboratories, and film sets. Michelle S. Height, director of the Ethel Waddell Gathee Honors Program at Spelman, points to the collaborative strength of the AUC. "We understand that collective value of the AUC. We see each other. What one of us does, we all do. We rise together," Height said. For Max Grace Brown, an incoming Spelman freshman psychology major from Raleigh, North Carolina, she wanted to be part of that rising tide. Brown, who was born in Atlanta, said the Spelman community combined with the city's rich black culture sealed the deal. She watched her mother, Vicky Suggs Jones, struggled to hold back tears as parents were asked to leave Sisters Chapel following the Sears emotional parting ceremony, where the 600 new students were formally bid farewell. "There's something powerful about being in a city where so many other young black people are working toward the same goals," Brown said. "It's not just about getting a degree. It's about being part of a network for life. Atlanta felt right." The next part of the article is titled, "Recruitment, Retention, and the CAU Approach." Across the AUC at Clark Atlanta, as freshmen are moving into their dorms, Sherry Peters, Vice President for Enrollment Management and Student Life, roared through campus on a golf cart with Provost Charlene Gilbert riding shotgun. Gilbert was helping students move in, while Peters was trying to keep things moving. CAU, which is in the middle of a $250 million capital campaign, received nearly 50,000 applications for this year's class of 2029. Of those, 19,000 were accepted, and about 1,215 are expected to arrive on campus. While you have 50,000 people knocking on your door and only 1,200 spaces, that's a blessing, a burden, and a responsibility, Gilbert said, adding that she is still looking for 15 more beds. We take it seriously, but that's the power of what's going on at Clark Atlanta University right now. We're doing everything to make it work. Fritch said, after the 2023 U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down race-conscious affirmative action in college admissions, CAU also saw an increase in middle-class black families choosing the Atlanta school over Ivy League options like Harvard or Yale. The average grade point average of incoming freshmen has jumped since 2019 from 2.8 to 3.71. The percentage of Georgia students at CAU has risen from 20% to 30%. Other than Georgia, the state with the highest number of students is California. While the AUC protects Atlanta's historic crown, Georgia State University has become the city's new engine of scale for black student success. For 9 years straight, GSU has awarded more bachelor's degrees to African Americans than any other nonprofit institution in the country, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics. In 2024, according to the University System of Georgia, 22,348 of GSU's 52,423 students, more than 42%, were black. Comparatively, only 7.5% and 6.4% of students at the University of Georgia and Georgia Tech were listed as black. Statewide, GSU educates 24% of all black students attending public universities. In 2012, it became the first U.S. institution to award more than 2,000 bachelor's degrees to African Americans in a single year, and it hasn't slowed since. In 2023, 2 years after M. Brian Blake became the school's first black president, GSU conferred 2,810 degrees to African American students, outpacing the number awarded to white students, 2,229. Just as important, GSU has narrowed racial graduation rate gaps to nearly zero. Since 2015, the African American graduation rate has risen 29 points, now standing at 53%. That change didn't happen by chance, university officials say. It came from deliberate interventions, predictive analytics to flag at-risk students early, proactive academic advising, and microgrants to prevent dropouts over financial emergencies. The next part of the article is titled, Making Students Feel Valued. Black higher education in Atlanta extends beyond the AUC and Georgia State. At Clayton State University, 62% of its 6,100 students are black, while at Kennesaw State, 28% of its 48,000 students are black. Atlanta Metropolitan State College, though not an HBCU, enrolls about 1,600 students, roughly 90% black, with an average age of 26. Founded in 1974 as a junior college, it attracts learners from across Georgia and internationally, including the Bahamas, the Gambia, Germany, Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. Our students see the campus as a safe space where past failures are not counted against them, said President Ingrid Thompson Sellers. Our staff and faculty care deeply, empowering students despite challenges of insecurities about higher education. Students feel valued. They are not numbers. The college offers certificates, associate degrees, and 6 bachelor's programs, with elementary and special education launching in spring 2026. The tuition is $107 per credit hour, about $1,284 per semester for 12 credits, with classes available on campus, online, or in hybrid formats. Affordability is an important element for many black students. The state's HOPE and Zell Miller scholarships help pay some or most of the tuition for Georgia high school graduates who attend in-state public universities. The final section of the article is titled, Why They Stay. From his boyhood home in Windsor, Connecticut, just 43 miles north of Yale, Marcus Blackwell's Atlanta roots still ran deep, even though he had no intention of going to school here. Summer vacations included trips to his grandmother, Krispy Kreme, and Morehouse, his dad's alma mater. Blackwell initially resisted following his father's path, wanting to forge his own. But after a leadership pre-college program at Morehouse and experiencing what he called unmatched black culture, he changed course. "I'd never experienced the freedom of being my full black self. Up north, our northern swag, do-rags, fitted caps, often came with negative perceptions, and my dad, being a Morehouse man and corporate guy, didn't let me lean into that style," Blackwell said. "But times are different now. In Atlanta, this is who we are." After earning a math degree in 2009, Blackwell stayed in Atlanta. In a pattern reflected in a 2018 study showing 30.7% of metro area black adults hold at least a bachelor's versus 21.8% nationwide. He worked at General Electric while pursuing music as a director and pianist at local churches, and recently left to launch Make Music Count, an app teaching math through popular piano songs. "The village that I've built here because of Morehouse makes Atlanta that type of black mecca where I can do anything," said Blackwell, who has settled into Atlanta's West Side with his wife, a Spelman graduate, and two children. "I don't feel like I would have gotten that in any city other than Atlanta. I've been set up for success here, and there wasn't any need for me to go anywhere else." That was the article titled, "How Atlanta Remains a Higher Education Mecca for Black Students." It was written by Ernie Suggs and published August 24, 2025 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is titled, "At Black Colleges, a Stubborn Gender Enrollment Gap Keeps Growing." This was written by Clyde McGrady and published April 4, 2025 in the New York Times newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, "Only 19% of students at Howard University are black men, whose enrollment levels at four-year colleges have plummeted across the board." Before stepping foot on Howard University's campus, Skylar Wilson knew she would see more women there than men, but just how many more stunned her. Howard, one of the most elite historically black colleges and universities in the nation, is only 30% men, 19% black men. "I was like, wow," said Miss Wilson, a 20-year-old junior. "How is that possible?" Howard is not unique. The number of black men attending four-year colleges has plummeted across the board. And nowhere is this deficit more pronounced than at historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. Black men account for 26% of the students at HBCUs, down from an already low 38% in 1976, according to the American Institute for Boys and Men. There are now about as many non-black students attending HBCUs as there are black men. The decline has profound implications for economic mobility, family formation, and wealth generation. Raj Chetty, a Harvard economist who uses large data sets to study economic opportunity, has found that the income gap between America's black and white populations is entirely driven by differences in men's economic circumstances, not women's. The causes are many: higher college costs, the immediate financial needs of black families, high suspension rates in high school, and a barrage of negative messages about academic potential all play roles in the decline of black male enrollment and college completion. Howard estimates that its cost of attendance for undergraduates easily exceeds $50,000 a year. If you are serious about reducing race gaps in economic opportunity, household wealth, etc., then our attention should be squarely focused on economic outcomes for black boys and men, period. Full stop, said Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men. But now, programs designed to nurture black academic achievement may be dismantled by the Trump administration, which deems them racist diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Cultural centers, mentorship programs, Workforce recruitment activities and scholarship programs are all threatened by the White House's promise to cut funding to universities that do not eliminate what it calls racial preferences. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump asked the Supreme Court to allow him to terminate more than $600 million in teacher training grants, which would decimate two of the Education Department's largest professional development programs. Both were designed to place teachers in underserved schools and diversify the educational workforce. It's a perpetuating cycle, said Dr. Cheryl Holcomb McCoy, chief executive of the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. If you don't see other black male educators, then it's hard for you to see yourself in that position. On Thursday, the Department of Health and Human Services targeted California medical schools for maintaining what Trump administration officials called discriminatory race-based admissions, though bolstering the number of black doctors has long been a goal of the medical establishment. Put simply, educational institutions may neither separate or segregate students based on race, nor distribute benefits or burdens based on race, Craig Traynor, the Education Department's acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, wrote in a memo to universities in February. Black educators say burdens are already distributed unfairly. Society undermines black men's belief in their own potential, starting from early education and continuing through professional development, said Dr. Derek Brooms, executive director of the Black Men's Research Institute at Morehouse College, an elite all-male HBCU in Atlanta. Colleges like Howard may be the starkest of manifestations. Peyton Garcia, a Howard sophomore, recalled being one of three men in his introduction to philosophy class, which has about 30 students. We did a Cuba trip, he recalled. I was the only male that was in the class. Recent shifts in higher education, driven in part by conservative policies in Washington, have wrought large changes in predominantly black colleges, positive and negative. The Supreme Court's ban on race-based college admissions drove up interest in some HBCUs and strengthened the application pool overall, Dr. Broom said. But he's still concerned about the long-term trend. Dr. Broom said that at this point, Morehouse may have to reevaluate its recruitment strategy, including looking abroad. Perhaps there may be some black men in Canada who may want to attend. On campuses like Howard's, the gender disparity is understood. Women run the place. Everybody knows the women dominate this campus, said Tamaris Darby, a 20-year-old sophomore at Howard. You see predominantly women out here running the positions, and then you see their friends, young women, showing up for them and supporting them, he said. It's different for the men. According to students and faculty at Howard, black male students can have difficult time finding both themselves and a community. One night last October, young men gathered in small groups on the Howard Yard and wrote down what they were most afraid of. I have a fear of failure, said Joshua Hughes, a senior who led the burning of the fears that night. I have a fear of letting my family down. I have a fear of not living up to my full potential. Some read their fears aloud before tossing their writings into a giant fire pit as a drumline banged African djembes. In 2019, Calvin Hatley, then a senior advisor to Howard's president, had asked how Howard could better engage men on campus. He put together a survey of students, faculty, and staff, and then hosted several barbershop listening sessions. Something clicked. We had these very detailed, emotional conversations around manhood, around masculinity, around relationships, said Mr. Hadley, now Howard's assistant provost for academic partnerships and student engagement. Male fears can work against college attendance, students said. Fears of failure may deter black men from higher education, even as fears of letting their families down drive them prematurely into the workforce, before their earning potential can be reached. Mr. Darby said many of his friends didn't have parents or family who attended college, or they thought the costs were prohibitive. So they were trying to find these other avenues to make money and to be successful, not thinking that college was the number one thing that was going to get you there, he said. As a middle schooler, Jerrane Holmes, a 20-year-old sophomore, recalled thinking, college? What is college? He added, I knew I just wanted a job. But in his Detroit area high school, he enrolled in a college readiness program, and it made all the difference. As a general proposition, young men are arriving on college campuses less skilled academically than women, Mr. Reeves said. That's even more true of men of color, black men. That leads to problems of completion, which are at least as significant as declining enrollment. The first year of college is crucial for male retention, and a lack of services can lead young men to feel isolated or that they don't belong, Dr. Broom said. If you can show you can keep people, that folks can persist to graduation, that becomes a recruitment tool itself, said Dr. Brooms. On a recent warm, breezy spring day on campus, Howard students lay on blankets chatting. Some set up tables to sell merchandise, displaying the famed entrepreneurial Howard hustle. Others campaigned for a student senate or royal court. The gender disparity was on the minds of the students. Christian Bernard, a 22-year-old senior from affluent Potomac, Maryland, is a third-generation legacy student. He was on the yard selling items from his clothing brand, emblazoned with the slogan, Worth It. He started the brand amid the turmoil and grief of June 2020, after the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer and the swell of Black Lives Matter demonstrations. He chose Howard for its soccer program and his family ties. Before injuries derailed his athletic career, he made strong friendships with his teammates. There's a lot of male camaraderie here at Howard, he said. Those studying the challenges that young black men face are careful to avoid a battle of the sexes. Women have faced historical challenges of their own. Some people perceive female gains as a threat to men in a zero-sum battle for resources and power. Mr. Reeves says that is a mistake, particularly when it comes to family formation. Asking the young men on campus how the gender gap affects dating will draw a sheepish grin. They understand their advantage. Young women are thinking about it too. Those ratios, said Navia Fincher, a sophomore, can be rough. A lot of the boys feel like they've got options, Miss Fincher said, which, if we're being honest, they do. The lack of college-educated black men could change family structures and breadwinning patterns, placing more financial burdens on black women. College-educated black women already have higher lifetime earnings than college-educated white women because they work more years over the course of their lives, despite lower annual earnings, according to the Kansas City Federal Reserve. For young women who care about the future of black America in general, all of this is alarming. We see a lot of school programs and districts that are giving up on students and giving up on black men before they even give them a chance, said Ms. Wilson. She's seen it in the male students she mentors. She said their teachers don't offer much encouragement. They expect them to be bad, she said. They expect them to be problems. That was the article titled, At Black Colleges, A Stubborn Gender Enrollment Gap Keeps Growing. This was written by Clyde McGrady and published April 4th, 2025, in the New York Times newspaper. My next reading is a response to the previous article I read. It's titled, 22% of Howard's graduating class are men. Here's what earning a degree means to five of them. This was written by Madison Lehman and published May 5th, 2025, in the Hilltop newspaper and its TheHilltopOnline.com website. The Hilltop is the student paper from Howard University in Washington, D.C. The New York Times recently released an article about black men's declining HBCU enrollment. Meanwhile, at Howard, where black men make up just 19% of the student body, five graduating seniors share their journeys, challenges, and their thoughts on the importance of self-belief. I want to be something. I want to try to do my best to save as many black boys as I can, Blake Spencer said. Spencer arrived at Howard as a business major, but soon realized his purpose lay elsewhere. Growing up in Flint, Michigan, where the water crisis shapes daily life, he witnessed firsthand the toll it took on his community. I wanted to be a help to the community that raised me, he said. I'm just trying to resolve as many medical ailments through environmental racism or through food deserts as much as I can. I just wanted to be a part of that front line. Now a graduating senior nursing major, Spencer's journey reflects that of four other black men who also came searching for something and, in discovering who they were meant to be, left transformed. Blake Spencer, Gregory Allen, Cameron Humes, Iriayo Kuku, and Quincy Baker are part of the 19% of Howard students who are black men, according to Howard's Institutional Research and Assessment Office. A recent New York Times article spotlighted the gender gap, but their stories speak to much more. The article highlighted the decline in black male enrollment at HBCUs. Nationally, the number of black men enrolled in college has dropped from 38% in 1976 to 26% today. According to data from Howard's Institutional Research and Assessment Office, 2,002 black men enrolled in Howard in 2024. Of the 399 black men seeking a bachelor's or equivalent degree, 185 completed the program in 4 years or less. Of the 1,001 black women seeking a bachelor's or equivalent degree, 652 completed the program in 4 years or less. For Spencer, the road to graduation demanded strength. After my sophomore year, I had to go back to Flint and work at a steel mill factory for 66 hours a week to pay my financial bill, he said. Howard's estimated cost of attendance for 2024 to 2025 was over $54,000. Financial strain was only part of it. Many felt pressure to succeed for their families. Once my baby brother was born, I was in a leadership position for life, Allen, a senior supply chain management major from Stockton, California, and the 48th Mr. Howard, said. Allen never planned to run for Mr. Howard, but in his junior year, he chose to take a leap of faith. I didn't want to graduate with regrets, he said. That choice led to a defining moment, sharing his baby brother's story on stage. It changed me as a man, a brother, a son. Kuku, a senior finance major from New Jersey, said overcoming the barriers required letting go of comparison and staying rooted in purpose. When it's your time, it's perfect timing, he said. You can't compare yourself to everyone else. You just have to keep doing what you are called to do. To fulfill their callings, many of the men turned to faith. When I came to Howard, the challenges I faced led me closer to God, said Humes, a political science major from Birmingham, Alabama. Kuku said prayer led him to Howard, where he was deciding between two universities. I prayed a lot, and I got an answer that it was Howard, he said. Allen also found peace in faith. He leaned to Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 through 34. Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself, he said. Every time I need it, that verse shows up. Faith didn't eliminate the struggle, but it gave them strength. Their belief, whether in God, themselves, or their purpose, shaped how they defined themselves and simultaneously what it meant to be a man. For Spencer, redefining manhood meant unlearning the narratives he grew up with. It's a process of non-learning, unlearning what you feel like was a necessary component of yourself, he said. What do I really like besides everything that I see in the media and what I've been socialized to believe I like? Spencer said this process brought him to photography, Africana studies, and medicine. He also said imagining a future isn't something many black boys get the chance to do. For some of them, it's hard to do while living in poverty and over-policed, violence-filled communities. A lot of people don't realize that kids living in these places don't really see life beyond 25 or 30, he said. Since I turned around 13, I have had 7 friends die. For him, the journey to manhood began in belief. You have to first realize that it's possible for me to live past 25, past 30, he said. Black boys, however, are often denied the space and resources to make that realization. He added that the inability to imagine a future is due to many reasons outside of our control. However, we have to learn how to instill that imagination within our youth. Baker, a senior political science major and TV and film minor from Staten Island, New York, learned that manhood isn't a monolith. Sometimes it's about knowing when to ask for help, he said. Allen emphasized a point about emotions for young black men. There's a certain standard men are expected to hold themselves to, but men should be able to feel their feelings. That's not weakness, he said. Reimagining manhood was part of their journey to becoming who they are now. The gender enrollment gap provided a unique environment to do so. For Cuckoo, the 70-30 gender split at Howard was evident, which was explored in the New York Times article. I thought people were exaggerating until I got here, he said. Still, he never felt out of place. Being around girls doesn't make you less of a man. It teaches you to lead and listen differently. Barker agreed. A lot of my friends are my homegirls, strong, intelligent black women, he said. Having them as friends gave me a different view of support and community. Baker saw himself in the article, especially in a quote from his friend Joshua Hughes about failure. We don't want to fail, not just for ourselves, but for our families who believed in us, Baker said. Spencer felt the article mischaracterized the issue. Rather, the real focus should be on the barriers to the future. According to Pew Research Center, the widest gender gap in college enrollment today is among white students. White women are now 10 percentage points more likely than their male peers to attend college, while for black students, the gap is 7 percentage points. Before you can ask a black boy to go to college, you have to first help him believe he'll live long enough to even get there, Spencer said. Spencer also questioned whether higher education should be framed as the sole path to empowerment. Is college saving us, or do we need to think about things differently, he said. Why is an institution the basis of our thought in terms of turning the black community around? We need to look deeper. College is more about assimilation than it is about saving us. Now, shaped by what they've learned and who they've become, these men are moving forward with clarity and purpose. Allen, a first-generation college student, said he feels like graduating is breaking generational curses. Graduating from here, even attending here, it feels like a dream come true, like something really out of a movie, he said. He is graduating not only as the reigning Mr. Howard, but also the 21st Mr. HBCU and a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. After graduation, Allen will be a consulting analyst and hopes to return to and further explore the arts. At Howard, Spencer found his calling and now plans to serve as a nurse and eventually earn a MD, PhD. Saving my community, step by step, as piecemeal as it may seem, is the ultimate goal, he said. Humes is pursuing environmental law. I saw firsthand how environmental injustices, soil pollution, air pollution, water pollution, all tied back generations, he said. His graduation, he added, sets an example for younger people in his family. For Cuckoo, graduation is a miracle. He's entering wealth management and hopes to grow his brand, write poetry, take mixed martial arts classes, and collect stories for his children. Baker is the first in his family to graduate from an HBCU. At Howard, Baker paved a path rooted in both law and film. I want to impact the community positively by being a lawyer, being representation people can count on, and offering perspective through litigation and film, he said. If they could give advice to their freshman selves, each man would give a message of perseverance and remaining true to oneself. Keep your head up, Baker said. Define what works for you. Just break through that glass ceiling. That was the article titled, 22% of Howard's graduating class are men. Here's what earning a degree means to five of them. This was published by Howard University's The Hilltop newspaper on May 5th, 2025, and was written by Madison Lyman. My next reading about school and education is, at a low point in U.S. race relations, black teachers are essential and at risk. This article was written by Edward Limpinen, and it was published August 22, 2025, in the University of California Berkeley News Service's news.berkeley.edu website. Millions of U.S. students are returning this month to schools that are struggling with strained resources, immigration crackdowns, and divisive culture war fights. Teachers are under intense pressure, and University of California Berkeley scholar Travis Bristol says that stress often falls most heavily on black teachers. In recent decades, initiatives to bring black teachers into the classroom have achieved great success, according to Bristol, an associate professor of teacher education and education policy at Berkeley School of Education. While that's been a plus for students, he says that classroom conditions, especially at urban schools, are at the same time driving black teachers out of education. Bristol and co-author Desiree Carver Thomas of the Learning Policy Institute surveyed the research in an essay last year and found striking insights. In classes led by black teachers, black students were more often happier and more academically successful, less likely to be suspended for infractions, and more likely to enroll in honors courses. Black teachers had positive impacts on the achievements of other students, too. But there were troubling signs. While the number of Latino and Asian American teachers rose, the proportion of black teachers in the United States was 8.6% in 1990, but only 6.1% in 2020, a decline of nearly one-third. Another study found that 41% of black teachers would leave teaching for a higher-paying job, compared to 34% of white teachers. Too often, the authors write, school administrators slotted young black teachers into the most challenging urban classrooms without sufficient training or support. Bristol is also the faculty director of Berkeley's Center for Research on Expanding Educational Opportunity and holds an appointment in the Department of African American Studies. A former student and teacher in the New York City public schools, he knows firsthand the conditions that produce success for black teachers and their students and the potential risks. UC Berkeley News. In a paper you co-authored last year, The Second Nader in American Race Relations was an essential context for considering the importance of black teachers. What is the Second Nader and why is it important? Travis J. Bristol. The Nader and Second Nader are not my ideas or my words. I'm just agreeing that we're living in this second wave of the lowest point of race relations since the end of chattel slavery in the United States. The first, of course, was the rise of the KKK and the Supreme Court's separate but equal decision in Plessy v. Ferguson. The second Nader, I would say, it began right at the moment that we elected the first black president of the United States. Almost ironically, the very moment that this country awakens to a black man, Barack Obama, being inaugurated and becoming the most powerful person in the world, it also awakens the cognitive dissonance with the racial order somehow shifting. The response has been a move to reestablish a racial order in which black people are the lower caste or one of the lower castes. In response to the election of President Obama, we began seeing this new wave of race relations in which people are more likely to be publicly lynched by members of the law enforcement and by rogue vigilantes. We began seeing rollbacks of affirmative action, then the first and second elections of President Trump. President Trump says of Obama, "This black man wasn't even born in the United States." UC Berkeley News. Why is that context important for understanding the role and importance of black teachers today? Travis Bristol. While we're seeing the ascendance of black people entering the power structure in the U.S., their presence in public schools simultaneously continues to decline. It's during the Obama administration that we began to see the clear and convincing evidence that black teachers improve outcomes for black students. So that's one reason why this second Nader is particularly concerning, particularly when there continues to be an assault on the progress we've made as a country. UC Berkeley News. Let's take a step back. When you think of the decades after the U.S. Civil War, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, segregation enforced by law, what roles did black teachers play in schools in the wider community? Travis Bristol. Black teachers in segregated classrooms tried their best to equalize the kind of learning environments that white children may have been having. They tried to create rigorous academic spaces so that, at the moment that we became an integrated society, these black children could compete and excel when compared to their white peers. In these segregated communities, in a country that black people knew didn't view them as people, black teachers provided a balm for their black students. I imagine across the South, it was quite commonplace for black children to know about and see black people being lynched. And so what these black teachers did was to create a safe space. It helped to reinforce messages that black children probably heard at church, and that they heard at their homes, and that they also heard at school. That you are not three-fifths of a person, even though you may be treated as such, but that you are black and brilliant and gifted. On average, black teachers continue to create this environment for black children. UC Berkeley News. Did that role change as civil rights and integration advanced starting in the 1950s and 60s? Travis Bristol. Once black students integrated into schools serving exclusively white students, black teachers and principals did not follow them. We know that about a third of black teachers lost their jobs. That meant that when black students entered into these, in many ways, violent white spaces, that they didn't have this balm to help them navigate. That was the historic value of black teachers before Brown versus the Board of Education, the historic U.S. Supreme Court case that struck down segregation in 1954. And that is one of the consequences when we quote-unquote integrated schools. UC Berkeley News. What has been the importance of black teachers for the academic achievements of black students? Travis Bristol. Before Brown, we didn't have robust data to make casual claims about black teachers' impact, or to say that a black teacher improved test scores relative to a white teacher. But we did have qualitative data, adults who point to the fact that they had these black teachers who set rigorous environments, so that when they integrated into white spaces, into college or post-secondary spaces, they felt adequately prepared. Then, as we point out in our paper from last year, from the 1970s through the 1980s, through the 2000s, the evidence is clear. Having a black teacher meant increased likelihood that the student would come to school, increased likelihood of scoring higher on a standardized test when compared to having a white teacher, increased likelihood of going to college. There's also a lower likelihood of being suspended when you have a same race teacher. UC Berkeley News. Do the benefits go beyond black students? Travis Bristol. For people who hold anti-black views, it's easy to dismiss these findings and not to support policies that seem to only benefit black people. But there's other recent research that shows decreased suspension rates for Latino students when they have a black teacher, also for Asian American students, or white students who look around and see that we live in a flat and interconnected world. White students prefer black teachers when compared to other teachers. Why? Because these students say black teachers expect more from us in terms of academic rigor. This is the point that I often underscore in my work with policymakers. There is a value for all students when they have a black teacher. UC Berkeley News. You said, for students who aren't black, one of the values of having a black teacher is that they get a sustained look at black competence and leadership. Travis Bristol. Having black educators really allows people to experience that they live and function in a society that is interconnected. We do white children a disservice when they get to my class, freshman or sophomore year, and they say to me very quietly, "Professor Ristel, you're the first black teacher I've ever had." If I have exposure as a high schooler, as an elementary school student, to black people who are my intellectual superior, then I am more able to function in an interconnected global community where I see black people as being like me, not being different or othered. So that when they become college professors at Cal, they've had a lot of exposure to black people and they're able to imagine them as having the same rank, if not higher. UC Berkeley News. A few years ago, a lot of your work was focused on black men as teachers. Have you now expanded your focus? Travis Bristol. I do think the focus on black men is important. The outcomes are clear. Black boys perform less well relative to black girls in K-12 schools. And that's true clearly in higher education. There have been news stories this year about the disappearance of black young men from historically black colleges and universities. There's a space to continue to bring attention to the experiences of black men and boys. I don't want that to be lost, and I want to be clear that my work in some ways perpetuated the focus on black men. But this hypervisibility prevents us from also thinking about the experiences of black girls. When compared to black boys, yes, they seem to be doing well. But when compared to Asian American young women and white women and girls, black girls are not doing so well. And so if we're focusing on black boys and on programs like My Brother's Keeper, then who are my sister's keepers, if you will? UC Berkeley News. Would it be fair to say that in the last 10 or 20 years, it's been a difficult time for teachers generally, but a particularly difficult time for black teachers? Travis Bristol. It's been a difficult time for teachers more broadly, and particularly who are teaching in urban settings. We've also seen that there have been a lot of investments, public and private, into increasing the number of teachers of color. In some ways, these investments have paid off. I became a teacher in many ways because the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, a foundation started by the Rockefeller Group, gave me a $25,000 grant and loan forgiveness to go to Stanford to get my teaching credential. We're actually seeing more people of color enter the profession over the last 20 years. But what is also true across those last 20 years is that we've also seen a decline in black teachers. We don't know necessarily what caused this decline, but what may have been some of the contributing factors were federal policies, dare I say, from a black president that punished or closed underperforming schools. Who were the students who underperformed in these schools? They were disproportionately black children. And who were the teachers who were attracted to those schools or tracked into those schools? Black teachers. When those schools closed during the Obama administration, just like during Jim Crow, those teachers lost their jobs and had difficulty being rehired. Particularly in urban settings, there have been policies and programs to increase the number of teachers, and teachers of color in particular. And those policies have been successful. So let's keep those policies. But let's also examine what's happening in schools. Once those black teachers arrive, why is there a revolving door? Black teachers leave just like any other teachers leave, because of the working conditions in their school. Well-intentioned policymakers are attracting black teachers and giving them incentives and placing them in the most challenging schools, believing that just by dint of their race, that creates a superhumanness that might allow them to succeed. Black teachers are attracted to these kinds of schools because they want to return to places that were similar to those from whence they've come, and to uplift students. But the conditions aren't present for them to succeed. UC Berkeley News. What can we, as a society, do to provide the support needed to retain the black teachers who are recruited and help them to have long, productive careers? This conversation has to start with leadership, essentially the individuals who are running the school. We're doing some of that work in California. There's a grant program that provides a 90% scholarship for people who receive a high-quality credential to become a principal. So you're ensuring then that people who are becoming school teachers are adequately prepared to engage in that work. We need to continue focusing on high-quality teacher preparation. It's unfair that we're going to place the most novice teachers in the most challenging conditions and expect that teacher alone to address centuries of historic discrimination and marginalization. This means that we should be placing social workers in schools where students have a great deal of challenges. It means that if families don't have enough food, that we're ensuring that students have access to food so that they aren't hungry, so that they can pay attention and their teachers can teach them. We're seeing some of this with the community school model here in California. UC Berkeley News. How optimistic are you that there is political will to make a sustained commitment to these promising programs? Travis Bristol. I am forever an optimist. At this moment, however, the easiest thing to do would be to capitulate to the strong man and to these ideologies which seek to take us back in time. But if we keep front and center this idealized notion of what America could be or should be, a society that is inclusive, diverse, and equitable, then efforts to diversify the educator workforce should not be viewed as a threat. They should be viewed as a means to fulfill the American project. That project centers diversity, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. That was the interview. At a low point in U.S. race relations, black teachers are essential and at risk. It was written by Edward Limpinen and was published August 22, 2025, at the website news.berkeley.edu, which is the website of the University of California at Berkeley News Service. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader Archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.